you know, I realized that bureaucracy wasn't my thing either. I wasn't really super thrilled about working with a large firm. I was too much of an entrepreneur at heart, didn't know it at the time. But I tell you, if somebody told me that I'd be where I am today, I would say you're crazy.
Welcome to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. In this podcast, Vince Menzione, a proven industry sales and partner executive, brings together technology leaders in this forum to discuss transformational trends and to deconstruct successful strategies to thrive and survive in the rapid age of cloud transformation. And now your host, Vince Menzione.
Welcome to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. My guest for this 72nd episode of the podcast is Linda Rose, a former CEO and entrepreneur who grew and sold technology businesses in the Microsoft partner ecosystem. I first met Linda about 3 years ago, and quite a bit has happened since then. Linda's book, Get Acquired for Millions, A Roadmap for Technology Service Providers to Maximize Company Value, is a definitive guide for technology organizations looking to be acquired. In the book, she provides strong guidance to business owners and operators on maximizing their organization's value, and it's a unique how-to guide to getting your technology company acquired. As an entrepreneur, Linda's story is fascinating, and we discuss her journey and the lessons she learned along the way. I also find her work essential to the thousands of partner development managers out there, working with these partners to better advise and coach their organizations. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed spending time with Linda Rose. Linda, welcome to the podcast.
Vince, so great to be here. Finally.
I know we've been talking about this for quite some time, and I am so excited to finally have you as a guest on Ultimate Guide to Partnering. And, you know, we've known each other. We've been in the partner ecosystem for some time. We both spoke at Christy Spokley's Extreme 365 event, 3 years ago?
Yeah, seems like a long time ago.
Yeah, and geez, I can't believe that's been 3 years and so much has happened now since then. And so I'm excited to have you as a guest. You know, you've been a successful partner CEO and now an author, so welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You know, your book, Getting Acquired for Millions, it truly is a roadmap for technology service providers to maximize company value. And I so enjoyed reading this book. And it's sort of out of character for me to read a book on finance or tips and tricks for what you do with your company. But I learned so much from the book, and I want to dig in here in a few moments. But first, for our listeners who don't know Linda Rose, can you tell us a little bit about your path or your journey to get here?
Absolutely. So I most recently spent, if you want to call it recently, 25 years as a Microsoft partner in the channel. I started two partner organizations, one back in 91, 92, CRM ERP partner, and then in 1999, 2000, I started a cloud infrastructure business, which is actually really called hosting back then. And then somewhere along the way there, I started a staffing firm as well. So it was pretty busy past. Wasn't a plan event. I'm not a technologist. I'm actually a CPA. I worked in public accounting. I was on the tax side of the CPA firm. I planned on, you know, when I graduated from college, becoming a partner. And I met my husband there. And they had rules back then. You couldn't date, let alone get married. And given the fact that I'm still with the same man for 33 years, I think it was probably a good decision. I left the firm and he went on to be a manager and it was up for a partner. And I just kind of moved on and did my own thing. But I realized that bureaucracy wasn't my thing either. I wasn't really super thrilled about working with a large firm. I was too much of an entrepreneur at heart, didn't know it at the time. But I tell you, if somebody told me that I'd be where I am today, I would say you're crazy. But you know, the universe opens up and you just kind of step in.
Yeah. Well, you know, you tell the story about what accidentally happened, right? Do you feel these years later in your journey that this was informed? You say, you know, maybe you were an entrepreneur at heart and didn't realize it at the time, but were there things that opened up for you? Were there pivot points or things that you realized about your experiences or motivations that drove you?
Yes. Well, of course, that accidental thing was me becoming pregnant and unexpectedly, and then not being able to get a job. I got laid off because it was the recession and I got laid off and I couldn't find a job because I was already showing and I wanted 4 months off, you know, the typical things as a new mom. And so it really forced me to go out, do some gig work, as we call it now. We didn't call it that before. And, you know, just it was really about putting food on the table initially. And I just enjoyed learning things. And one thing, tax work led to accounting work, which led to ERP work. And so, you know, for me, as I just kind of said earlier, you know, the universe just opens up and you just kind of need to step in and, you know, just go with what you think is right. And that's kind of always been my motto. There's kind of an old German expression, but it translates in English to kind of like self is the man. And to me, that means never be afraid to go out and do something on your own, because you can't wait around for somebody to give it to you. Just gotta do it, as Nike says.
I love that advice. And so you became a CEO of a technology company in what was at the time, and in many ways still is, a male-dominated world. What was that like for you?
You know, honestly, Vince, I never viewed it that way. I just viewed it as, I was always pretty confident in my skill sets. I've always made it a point to continuously learn, to always be a few steps ahead of everybody else. And the fact that I just knew my trade, I learned how to use the Microsoft products. I spent lots of time learning that. And I was confident in my skill set. And that's kind of really all I needed. You know, there were a few occasions where, you know, some of the guy CEOs that were my clients, you know, I'd get, you know, a couple passes made at me. I was younger then, of course. But, you know, you just kind of, I hate to say learn to live with it, but you just kind of have to in a way, but deal with it in a constructive way. And I did have to have a sit down from time to time with the CEO, but, you know, all ended well. And, you know, to me, it was about growing a business. And I didn't really think of myself as a man or a woman. I just thought of myself as, this is what I know, I'm going to go do it.
Were there any role models that you looked up to at the time? I had Tiffany Bova on the podcast recently, and she said, you can't be what you can't see. Was there anybody that you saw in the future, or maybe another version of you that you looked up to at that point to say, this is the person I want to grow into?
You know, not really. I mean, certainly weren't any women back then. I did have a group of guys that I actually worked for initially. They were commercial developers out of all things, and they built skyscrapers in San Diego. And they were an interesting, eclectic group of guys. And they were my client. I did a lot of tax work for them initially, a lot of limited partnerships. And they'd always invite me down to the bar downstairs in their building afterwards for a drink. And I was like almost the only girl they ever invited down. And I think part of it was because I wasn't offended by some of the language that they use. I would laugh at their jokes. They were all good, actually. But, you know, that's when all the good conversations happen, right? Just like at a conference, the good conversations typically happen at the bar. And I learned so much from these guys, and they were great. They took me under their wing. And whenever I had questions or I was afraid to do something, because trust me, I was afraid to do a lot of stuff back then, they would just give me the confidence to do it. And one individual in particular became a board member for a couple of my companies, and very instrumental. And I still thank him to this day for his guidance, for sure.
So I love that you wrote this book. Can you take our listeners through the genesis of how you got to write the book? Like, what happened with your businesses and how did you get to this spot?
Yeah. So as I said before, I had the three companies. I sold all three of those companies over time, one in 2008, one in 2013, and the last one in 2017. And I learned a lot during that process, made a ton of mistakes, left a lot of money on the table. And I really wanted to share that knowledge, because I read a quote that Jay McBain wrote. I know he's been a guest on your podcast, that he wrote back in October of 2017. And that quote was, 40% of the channel will age out by 2024. Mm-hmm. And that article just so hit me. I mean, it was really what prompted me to write the book, because I realized, oh my gosh, there's going to be so many partners in the same position that I just went through that don't have any idea how to prepare their company for a sale and have so much to share. And so I did a lot of research. I did a lot of interviewing of private equity firms, of buyers, of brokers, and decided to come up with this book written from a CEO's perspective that talks about M&A, but not like an M&A book, right? I'm a numbers person, and I've read, trust me, 20, 30 M&A books, and there's parts of this where my eyes glaze over. And I just wanted this to be just down in the trenches. Here's how it is. You know, this is the resources that you can use to get better. That's the kind of book I wanted to write. And it took me 18 months to do it.
You know, it's amazing. I advise technology organizations myself, and many of them struggle with the advice you provide here. Why do you suppose so many of these technology companies struggle here with this move or the movement to sell the organization?
You know, I think, Vince, the reason is because, you have one mindset when you're building a company and you're growing revenue. That mindset is different than when you're building a company to sell. And, you know, you hear about people saying, oh, you should never go into a business without an exit plan. And, you know, I heard that too back in the early days. And I'm like, well, that's not fun. Who wants to think about an exit? I want to think about growing my company. I want to dominate the West Coast. You know, I had all these plans of growth. And that's more exciting. That's more fun to think about that. But yep, the reality absolutely. Is, if you really are planning for an exit, first of all, you can get to from point A to point B so much quicker. And B, you focus on different things. And I use an example of a $5 million company in a lot of my webinars where I say, this is one $5 million company and this is another $5 million company. And guess what? This one's worth like three times more than this one is. And the reason is because this company focused on recurring revenue. This company focused on cloud. This company focused on a management team. And you know, if you just really focus on the right things and prepare, it's amazing what you can do in a short period of time. And I see it over and over again, Vince, because once the CEO starts working with me, so I've taken multiple people out and sold them. And it's so fun to watch because once they have that mindset, okay, now I'm going to sell my company. I'm usually working with them from anywhere from 9 months to this last company, a year and a half. And you see them create revenue and hit all of their growth patterns that they've never done in the past. And it's like, you know, it's because they're focused, because they're really focused on what is important. And it's just amazing. And that's really where I see people miss the mark. They just focus on top line revenue growth and bottom line. And there's more to it than that.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. And, you know, they don't apply, you know, I almost consider you when you discuss your what you do for these organizations, you're almost like the financial fitness coach. Like you're coming in and, you know, somebody knows that they need to go on the program, but they're not doing the things they need to do. And you break it out into what you call the 8 key value maximizers. And I look at this as like, oh, these are the things I need, the steps I need to take. Can you take our listeners a little bit through that? I love the fact that you got highly tactical here with these 8.
Yeah. So really how I came up with the 8 to begin with was really talking to people who had sold their companies and said, you know, when the buyer came in, what did they look like? What did they look at? And then, of course, I spoke to buyers and as well as private equity firms and said, you know, what are you looking for beyond the top line revenue growth and beyond the EBITDA numbers? What's important to you? And that's how these 8 came up. And they're not all valued the same way. So I wrote an entire assessment around it, by the way, because, you know, that would be the numbers accountant in me, right? It's one thing to write a book, which is a bunch of words, but I needed an assessment to go along with it. And so if you take the value maximizer assessment, it will give you your potential market value based upon these 8 value maximizers. But more importantly, Vince, it'll tell you the money that you're leaving on the table. And if you change certain things, you could actually, you know, grow the value of your company, not the revenue, but the value. And that's really where that mind shift is. And so, you know, I would say 3 that stand out constantly. And the first one I talk about is financial fitness, because, you know, even though you may be running your books on an accrual basis, I can't tell you how many people's P&Ls I look at and cost of goods sold is wrong. And you're going, well, why is that really important, Linda? Because it all, you know, shakes out in the bottom line. Yes, it does. But when somebody comes in, especially a strategic buyer and looks at your financials, they look at your gross profit margin. That is probably the most important number to them other than year over year growth, because everything below that could potentially go away, right? Because they're integrating you into their organization. And so all the G&A and sales and marketing, you know, the sales maybe not so much, but a lot of the marketing, that just goes away. That's where the economies of scale come. And so not having the right gross profit margin has retraded more deals than I can possibly tell you. And what I mean by retrading is like somebody gives you an LOI and says, okay, Linda, I'm going to pay this much money for your company. But when they go in to do the due diligence and realize, oh, your gross profit margin isn't 60%, it's only 40. Well, oops, let me take that offer and move it down. And that's why that is so key. People just, you know, they go, okay, well, you know, above the line, below the line, that's fine. But it's so important when it comes to actually offers and LOIs and what you ultimately get for your company. So that's just one. The other one that I think people don't realize is just the value of their revenue, and really not just having one or two revenue lines, but being able to take your revenue and bucket it out into different ways. And that means maintenance, it means managed services, it means consulting, it means product, and understanding what the gross profit margin is on each one of those revenue lines. Because trust me, somebody will ask you about that. And when I ask business owners, I'm like, okay, I see multiple different lines of revenue on your P&L. What's the gross profit margin by each line? And then I get this really quiet, you know, well, this is the overall. Well, how do you know if you're not losing money in one of them? Well, it's a gut thing, you know. Well, I think you should go out and figure it out, because a buyer's going to want to know that. And I can bet you one of them is doing a heck of a lot better than others. So those are, you know, those are just a couple of things. One of the easiest fixes I think people need to do is really look at their unique value proposition and where is it on your site? It should be up in your hero image. I can't tell you how many partners, I would say like 80% of partner websites, their unique value proposition is they've been in the channel for 25 years and they have, you know, X amount of years of expertise on staff and they cover this geography with these products. That's not a unique value proposition.
No, it's not.
Right.
I'm just going to say something here. I coach organizations on this as well, because a lot of them struggle with how to present themselves to their alliance partnerships like Microsoft or Sage or whoever, and saying, this is the one thing that you should know about us, and this is why you should bring us into your customers.
Exactly.
So would you stack rank these? I mean, or are they stack ranked?
They're not necessarily ranked in that order, but there are some that are super important. And I would say the financial fitness is up there. If you can't present a good set of financial statements that are gap aligned, that have things allocated correctly, you lose a lot of credibility early in the game. So that, you know, that's almost like a given. You have to do that. And I sometimes spend months working with my clients and helping them restate their financials and get ready for that. And that's partially the CPA in me. And I don't know too many business brokers that do that, but I do spend a lot of time in it, and it makes up for it in the end. And then I would say that, you know, really the revenue, understanding that, and intellectual property. Here's the other thing. Everybody has intellectual property. You do not have to be an ISV to have intellectual property. And, yep. You know, yes, there are patents, which nobody has. There are copyrights, which everybody has. There are trademarks, which everybody has. But what people forget about is their secret sauce.
And yeah, I agree.
Us is your own internal IP on how you stand up something on Azure, or how you know, whatever it is that you do. Every partner has their own secret sauce that makes them unique. And what partners don't realize is they need to package that and give it a name instead of billing the stuff out by the hour. They need to step back and look at what is it that they do constantly, give it a name, give it three options, and that becomes, you know, your secret sauce, and that becomes IP. And most partners don't even think along those lines. And it's so important to be able to actually articulate that and give it a name and give it a value.
You know, I so agree with you. And, you know, you wrote this book before COVID. So, you know, we've talked about this time like no other. What are you seeing now that you didn't see then when you wrote it?
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, this whole concept of verticalization, right? You know, verticalize along an industry. And you know, some people are feeling being in the wrong industry right now, right? I mean, there are definitely partners that, because they verticalized specifically in an industry, are feeling it. And so, you know, I think verticalization is important, but I think having a solution that can possibly cross multiple verticals is probably the better answer. And, you know, I always joke because, you know, I got the same thing from Microsoft, verticalize. And, you know, I'd always come up with, well, yeah, you know, we're heavily into life science and all this, but, you know, did I have a solution for life science? No, but what I did have is a solution that crossed multiple verticals. And when I talk about that, I mean that more in my cloud infrastructure practice, where I really focused on companies that were highly regulated. So they were either SOX or, you know, they're publicly traded. So they had SOX regulations, or they were FDA and they had CFR Part 11 compliance issues, or they had HIPAA. And I was able to provide with my services a level of security that went above and beyond even Azure at the time. And that in a sense was my vertical, but it was very horizontal. So, you know, it was like, and because of that, because I got known for that level of security, I attracted people who were in the financial services space, who were in the healthcare space, who were in the life sciences space. And so the verticals came to me in a way. It was kind of worked its way around a different way. But, you know, when you sit down, you look at your customer base, you got to look at yes, the verticals that you're served, but what is it that you're doing that could actually cross verticals and that's unique? And I think that's what I would probably look at a little bit differently in this COVID time period, because if you're just focused on retail, you know, that could have been a problem for you. I mean, I think that's coming back, but yeah, I think that's what I would do differently.
Yeah. I've been talking about the fact that there are going to be winners and losers in this, you know, this new net new or new economy or new normal that we call it. And to your point, some took it a little bit harder than others. Some markets are expanding. And we're going to see new solution sets and new capabilities that we never saw before, because we have to think differently in terms of how business is conducted.
Absolutely.
So, you know, what struck me when I was reading the book, I just recently had Brent Combest, who leads the local and national partners at Microsoft. And we were talking about his partner development managers and how he coaches them to be advisors and adjunct board members to their partners that they manage. What struck me about the book is like, wow, this would be a great guide to help those partner development managers to be better equipped to support their partners. And we didn't have that capability when I was at Microsoft, now that I think through it. Have you ever thought about pulling together a workshop or a boot camp here to help the tech giants be more successful with their partners?
Yes, you know, I have, and I've actually done a few things for Microsoft in the past. I'm really, you know, what resonates with people with the way I position this is I come at it from a CEO and not necessarily what Microsoft wants you to do, right? I mean, we align in so many different ways if you think about it. I mean, we talk about recurring revenue, we talk about cloud, we talk about package solutions, but I talk about it from a let's make some money perspective. Let's look at the gross profit margin perspective. I think about it always first and foremost as a business owner. And, you know, we all drink the Microsoft Kool-Aid and some of it's better than others. And, you know, there have been products, I can think of over the 25 years that I've implemented that are not here anymore and they weren't a good solution. But always I made the decision based upon what's good for my company and my bottom line and not necessarily to satisfy my PDM. And so, you know, but yet again, we align. We align around value proposition. We align around revenue. We align around sales and marketing. We align around intellectual property. But I just look at it at a different way. And, you know, one of the things that I really want to do and I'm working on right now is creating a course that I'm going to launch probably here in the first couple of months of 2021. And that is how partners prepare their company to be sold, because it's not something that they can do overnight. When I sold my last company to a national CPA firm, I had about a 3 or 4 year window in which I was preparing Rose ASP to be sold. And I was very busy during those 3 years. I had some guidance from a private equity firm and said, you know, you need to get your numbers to look like this and your management team to look like that and your customer, you know, concentration to look like this. And it took me really 3 years. I already had a lot of recurring revenue, but it took me 3 years to get that right. And, you know, people pick up the book and they go, or they don't buy the book and say, well, I'm not ready to sell yet. Well, I got news for you. It takes a long time to prepare this. It takes years potentially. And that's what I want to teach, is how people start thinking and acting now about something they want to do down the road. Because, you know, when I talk to partners, a lot of them say, yeah, I'm going to sell. It's probably something I'm going to do 5 years down the road. I love that. I talk about this a little bit in the book too. It's like, always 5 years down the road, right? Vince, you've heard that. Oh, I'm going to sell
in 5 years.
And then you talk to him 2 more years later, and you see him again at the conference. Like, oh yeah, it's going to be about 5 years down the road. And the reason the number is five is because A, they're thinking about it. They know they need to do this one day. And five is a long enough period of time where they're not freaking out their employees, because as soon as you tell your employees you're going to sell your company and everybody like goes, what? And there's a lot of fear and doubt and uncertainty that goes around that. So you don't tell your employees you're going to sell. And if you are transparent and say, yeah, I'm thinking about doing this 5 years down the road, well, that doesn't freak anybody out, because it's, you know, a lot can happen in 5 years. But I don't see that anybody's doing the preparation. Very few people, let's put it that way, are doing that preparation during that time period. So I am going to create a class and I am going to launch it this first quarter of 2021. I've absolutely decided to do that.
Well, you know, it strikes me when you say 5 years, it's almost like, well, I can kick it down the road a little bit further, putting it out 5 years. Do you think there's a mental game going on about selling the company that's happening with these entrepreneurs?
Oh, there's absolutely a mental game going on. You know, one of the books that I wish I had read very early on, which I actually didn't read until after I sold my company, but man, it was still a good read. And it's a book by Bo Burlingham called Finish Big, How Great I think it's called How Great Entrepreneurs Exit Their Companies on Top. And it's really about, you know, mentally preparing yourself for that next journey in your life. And I so wasn't mentally prepared for that. And if you think about it, you know, pretty much all of us are, you know, true entrepreneurs. That's why we're doing what we're doing. And, you know, once you're an entrepreneur, you just don't sell your company and not be an entrepreneur anymore. I mean, that still lives within you, right? And so you still need to do something meaningful. And typically, if you're an entrepreneur, you need to do it for compensation, whether you need the money or not, right? Like my big thing now is I work for toys, right? Like, you know, as the book says, I got acquired for millions, right? So I don't need to get up every day and work, but I'm an entrepreneur and I like to make money. And so, you know, what gets me up is what am I going to buy with my new toy, right? And so I think a lot of people are scared because they know they're entrepreneurs. They know this is what gets them up in the morning. Yeah, you know, you can go out and play tennis and have golf games and do all that, but that gets old pretty quick. And people realize they have nothing else to move on to, and they hold their company for that reason. And Vince, that was me in the 12th hour. I said to my husband, like, what am I going to do, Glenn? I just don't know anything else. And I for certain can't work for anybody else. Nobody would want me part of their organization. I'm just way too, you know, too much of an entrepreneur and see it my own way. And so I think you really have to look internally. And this book is a great read on how you do that and figure out what it is that you're going to do next. And here I am helping other people and have written this book, but it was writing the book that took me through that process and made me realize I have something to give in this next phase of my life.
So how did you get there?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny how that happened. So I sold my company in April. I hung around till July, and they only wanted me for 45 days after I sold the company because it was really a 98% recurring business. And they're like, Linda, you know what? We don't need you anymore. Off you go. You have a great team. They can run it. So I left, but I had to hang around until July because I had some speaking engagements still at Inspire, and I wanted to finish those up. And then like 3 days later, I donned my backpack and started hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. And I wanted to hike all 2,650 miles, but I was starting the trail too late in the season. There's no way I could do that. So I decided, all right, I'm just going to hike 500 miles because that's all you can do without a permit. And so I started in Oregon. I started in Southern Oregon, Crater Lake, and then I just started hiking north. And I needed that time, Vince, to just let go of being a CEO. I needed that time to be out in the forest, to just give my mind an opportunity to wander and just to figure out what I wanted to do next in my life. Well, I'm like, I don't know, 150 miles into the trail, which I did by myself. And I ended up running into this guy who was there from the Czech Republic. There's a lot of Europeans that hike this trail because it's one of the very few trails that is this long. And anyway, Vladimir was from the Czech Republic, and he was an IT guy. He was a network engineer and did a lot of coding and did a lot of BI and stuff like that. And we were like 3 years age difference. And so we kind of hiked the same hike, so to speak, right? We did the same amount of miles per day. And so we had a lot in common. And so I was, you know, just, he was like my psychiatrist. You know, you're hiking 20 miles a day and you're, you know, 10, 15 hours, you know, hitting the dirt. You got a lot to talk about, right? And he told me about his life story. And I'm done. He's like, Linda, you need to put all this in a book. Because I told him, I'm like, Vladimir, there's so much I can't do. I have this non-compete. My hands are tied for the next 5 years. He goes, Linda, you have to write a book. And it just dawned on me. And he's like, he's absolutely right. And so when I left the trail and I went back home, I started writing the book. And that's how it all began.
It's amazing. I mean, I love the fact, by the way, that the hiking piece, I've never been a hiker before. So I really kind of vicariously lived through that in your discussion and in the book. Was there an opening up in your mind that happened, you know, not being unplugged, not being on the cell phone for, you know, countless hours, social media, all the things that we deal with? Like, what was that experience like for you?
There were so many things. I mean, the unplugging was very important. And when you did have cellular connection, you know, it was to send the few messages out to your family members saying, yeah, I'm still alive. So most of the trail is without cellular connection. I mean, you do have GPS, so you know where you're going. But other than that, no. But I tell you, there were a few times on the trail where there were sort of life or death moments. And it, of course, you don't plan for that. You don't want that to happen. But there were a couple of times for me. And I remember one specifically in Washington where I was in Goat Rocks area, and I was getting ready to do the Knife's Edge, which sounds ominous to begin with, and is okay. It's not so bad as long as the wind's not blowing, because you're basically got the top of this ridge line. It's just a sheer drop down both sides, and the trail is not more than a foot wide. And it's, you know, if you have height issues, it's definitely a challenge. I don't have height issues, but I was just getting to that point, and I had to traverse some snow on the side of this mountain, which was also very steep. And I didn't have clamp-ons, and I didn't have an ice pick, because there shouldn't have been any snow at this time of year. It was August, but I was up in, I don't know, 5,000-6,000 foot altitude. And so somebody had gone before me, several people had gone before me, and they had kind of post-holed through it. So I just kind of planted my feet in that area, but the trail kind of divvied down to the left. And when I got to the bottom of the post-holing, I noticed that the trail was kind of up 5 or 6 feet up to the right. And so I had to scramble up the side of this mountain to get back on the trail. Well, I don't know, it was a 45-degree incline or something like that. I looked down, and there's like nothing between me and a lake that's like 1,000 feet down. I kid you not. It was a straight, no rocks to hold on to, no boulders, no roots, no trees, no nothing. It's just straight down shale. That's it. And as I'm starting to scramble up the side of this hill, I'm losing dirt. Dirt's coming out from underneath me, and I'm not getting anywhere. And I have a full pack. I've got like 30 pounds on my back, because, you know, I had like 3 or 4 more days before I was going to do the next resupply and water and all that good stuff. And I realized I'm on the side of this mountain. There's nobody else there. And I realized, you know what? I could die like right here. Like, this is like a one wrong step, Linda, and you're done. And I'm there, and, you know, it's just all of the emotions you could possibly have. I'm now crying because I'm there alone. And I'm like, you know, I'm cussing myself out, going, what the F possessed you to do this? But, you know, that's when everything in you kicks in, all the adrenaline comes about, and you're sitting there, and I'm talking to myself, Linda. I'm like, okay, Linda, we have a choice here. We can die or we can live. Take your pick, which one's going to be, but just get on with it, right? And so I just, every second and fiber in my body just crawled up this hill, and I got to the trail, and I cried some more because I made it. And then for the next 2 hours as I was going through this knife edge, I was still on sketch alert. But, you know, when I went to bed that night in my tent, I thank God that I was still alive. But when I finally got to my resupply place, because I think it took like 3 days for me to get past all that, something happened in me, Vince, and it's like my own interior glass ceiling broke. It made me realize I can be so much stronger, be so much more, I don't know. It was like my own personal glass ceiling had been lifted, and I shattered through it, and things that seemed like insurmountable that I was thinking in my head all of a sudden weren't insurmountable anymore. They were like small issues. Like, I had just climbed up the side of this mountain. That is nothing. That was something, right? And then it just, this, I came back, and like things that were difficult were no longer difficult for me. It was just in my mind. And, you know, I talk about it in the book as, you know, breaking your own glass ceiling and just going out and challenging yourself, and, you know, go jump out of an airplane or do something that you just would be scared to death to do, because I guarantee you at the end, you come back a stronger person.
I love that. I love that. Boy, what a great story, and what great advice for our listeners. I think we all, you know, my last guest, Tiffany Bova, said, be bold, right? Why do we hold ourselves back sometimes? And now you're offering, like, you've done this, 3 companies, you know, you went through this experience of successfully selling the last one. And there's so much value for others that you're providing through both the book, but now your workshops, the process, you know, and the work you do individually with organizations or owners, I should say. And so I just love that you're doing that. It's inspiring to me.
Thank you. It's been fun. It's been a great journey.
So Linda, you know, you wrote this book, and I'm so fascinated by how people do that. Like, I, you know, I have this book in my head that I want to get out, and I keep kicking it down the road a bit. What was that process like for you?
It's interesting because, you know, Vince, I don't consider myself a writer. I'm an accountant. And so the world speaks to me in numbers and not in words, right? So my partner for a very long time, Rebecca, you know, I would write a press release and I'd hand it to her, and she could just glance at it from afar and go, okay, we need to fix this, 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 and this. And then she would hand me a list of numbers. I'm like, no, that doesn't add up. You know, I mean, I was a numbers person. And she was a words person. And so for me to sit down every day and write, there were days where it was a challenge. It just wasn't coming down to it. And I would, I have to actually carve out days and sit there and go, okay, today I'm going to write. And usually the morning would start out with mimosa because that's kind of what got me to that side of the brain working. I needed a little help there. But I found as I got through, you know, as time went on, the writing became easier. It took a long time to really get the outline together. And here's the one thing I didn't want to do, Vince. I didn't just want to write another M&A book. I wanted to write something that was meaningful, that people would get a lot out of. I didn't want to write a fluff piece. It was just, it had to be a resource that people could pick up from time and time again and go, well, let me reread that chapter, or let me think about this, or let me see what she said about that. And because I've read so many books where, you know, there's just paragraph and page after fluff. It's like, okay, when are they going to get to the point here? And that is not who I am. People who know me know I'm really direct to the point because there's just not a lot of patience here, right? And I just needed to write a book that way. And so when I was researching, like, you know, how many words I need to have in my book, people said, oh, you need to have between 60 and 80,000 words to have a decent, you know, spine. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's like a lot of words, right? And then at the end, it turned out being like 100,000 words, almost 300 pages, but there's a lot of graphs and pictures in there and examples. And I don't feel like any of it is fluff. Like, I feel like all of it is really useful information. And being a CEO myself, no one's got time to read something that just doesn't get to the point. And that was what was so important for me. So at the end of the day, that's what I did. And I also wanted to be able to explain all the conversations I had with all these other partners. So I came up with my fictitious character, Robert, who we lived through Robert and his experiences throughout the book, because I didn't want to just talk about me and my experiences. I wanted to talk about all the stories that all the other partners told me about and said, okay, Linda, you can't say it was me. Like, this is off the record. You can't say it was me and my company. And I'm like, no problem. I've got this character. His name is Robert. And so a lot of those stories come through Robert, and it's great because he pops up throughout the book, and it's a fun read. I think there's a lot of content in there, but then you hear about Robert, he really brings it home. So yeah, it was a long process, but you know, I think it's a good book for people who really want to do this. And it's very niche. There's no other book about this for technology service providers. It just doesn't exist. Well,
and that's what I love so much about it, because it spoke to and there's what, 300, 400, 500,000 of these organizations out there. Nobody's written a book specifically for them. I love the way you organize the book into three sections. And to your point, you can go deep, you can skim around, you can find the area that you want to focus in on, or you can come back to it many times. So I love that. It's a tome that can sit on your shelf and be available to you at any point in time during this process. So I commend you on that. You know, I'm also, for our listeners, we're going to provide a free Audible sample to our listeners. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about that sample?
Yes. So actually, the sample is the first chapter in the book. And this is about Robert, and he's getting ready to sign the agreement to sell his company. And we start out with what's going through his head and the journey that he's taken to get there. So the first chapter, we start with Robert and what he's been through and the, you know, how many years it took him to get to this point. And now he's signing over his entire company. So it starts out a really fun point and it grabs everybody's attention. And then, you know, we kind of get into the nuts and bolts of it. But yeah, so it's on my website. I think we'll have a link to it. And I want to shout out to, you know, I know you're all about partnering, and that has not ended for me. And I think I was at Summit a couple of years ago, and I ended up talking to Rick McCrutchen out of Canada and Mark Smith out of New Zealand, you know, so we've got an international yep. group of partners here. And we were sitting out in between two sessions and having a break, and we were talking about the book a little bit. And I think it was Mark that said, you know what, I don't read books anymore. It's all Audible. And I'm like, you know what? I thought about putting the book on Audible, but there's so many graphs and charts in here. I don't know how that would work. And so I left that conference and I went home and I started looking at some other people who had books on Audible that had lots of graphs and charts. And I realized it can be done. And so I went into a studio and recorded the book on Audible. And that was probably another good thing, because I realized that, you know, that's how I pick my books. I have my Audible subscription. And, you know, sometimes I see a book that looks good, but I'll go out and start listening to an Audible first. And if I really like it, then I'll go get the hard copy because I'm still a hard copy kind of gal. And I found that partners are enjoying that as well. So the whole book is on Audible if that's your jam, but that first chapter is out there available to everybody.
And what was that experience like recording, like, you know, playing back or speaking out your book on Audible? What was that experience like for you?
You know what? You think reading your book, own book is easy. It's not. I was in a recording studio, professional recording studio here in San Diego for a week, and they were fabulous people. And, you know, there's somebody in the, you're in one booth and they're in the other sound booth and they're like, okay, that's not what you wrote in the book. I'm like, oh, okay, let's go back. And so it turned out really well. And the gentleman that reads all of the John Gresham books, you know, of course we've all heard of John Gresham, the narrator for all the John Gresham books. He was there as well. And I met him at a break and he was so kind to actually read my intro and my author page. And he's just an amazing voice. So it was fun to meet other authors there recording their books as well. So it was a great experience. I'm so glad I did it.
What a great experience. And so we're going to shift gears a little bit here. And, you know, we have a condensed schedule today. So, you know, we've both been around this world of partnering in the channel ecosystem. What attributes do you see that make the most successful partnerships, or what are the best experiences you've had working with partners?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, partnering is important now as it was before. And I think really, because a lot of times you partner with somebody that's new and you're testing the waters. And then there are other times where you have people that you're tried and true partners that you go to time again. But sometimes you really have to go outside of your comfort zone and connect with somebody that can really supplement something that you're not doing for a client. And I think it's so important that you set the boundaries, that you communicate, that you both know, you know, who's doing what, and that you come together and look out for one another as partners. You know, many times, and as I partner today with people, you know, if I hear something is not going well because it's, you know, something that the other partner should be working on, I try to be proactive and go to that partner and say, look, you know, here's what I'm hearing. You know, maybe you want to be a little proactive on this and get back to them. And of course, you know, it's coming from a place of love and it's coming from a place of success, not of ego. And I think if you can get to that place and have that kind of communication with the people that you're partnering with, that's where the success is. That's also where the failure is, right? If you are not communicating with your partner, that's where those partnerships fall apart. And I think that's the biggest key. It really is. It's just defining very early on who's doing what and then communicating outside of just, you know, working with that customer, but from partner to partner.
Yeah. So a level of intimacy and transparency with the partner.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's peel back on your life and career a little bit more here. You know, we talked a little bit about your journey, but entrepreneurship is not for the faint of heart. Did you ever suffer from imposter syndrome when you got started?
Many times, actually. You know, writing the book, I suffered from imposter syndrome. Getting into the whole M&A space, initially, I felt a little bit as an imposter, even though I had three of my own deals under my belt. So I think, I don't care how old you get, I think as you grow and as you take on new challenges, there's always a little bit of that imposter syndrome. But if you have somebody, if you have a good mentor that you can reach out to that can help you pass that. And even in this last go around with the book and my current career as an M&A advisor, you know, I had people that sort of helped me through that too. And so, you know, those mentors are so important. And they're typically not the people you pay money to, right? I mean, you can have advisors that you pay money for. You can be in a CEO roundtable. I've always found that the best mentors are the people that typically are a little bit older than you, that have gone through it and have done it themselves. There's no ego around, you know, their success. They're willing to tell you, you know, how they succeeded, but more importantly, their failures. I think you learn so much from people's failures and what not to do as you do from people's successes. And sometimes it takes a certain type of person to acknowledge their failures and acknowledge it publicly to you so you can learn from it. And so, you know, having those mentors is so important. And a lot of times it is your client, right? I have to look back and say, you know, most of my mentors were clients along the way, people that believed in me, could see what I was doing, that believed in my success and were willing to share their knowledge with me.
That's great. That's great advice. What about, you know, you and I are both active in diversity and women in the cloud and some of these organizations. and events. What advice do you give to female leaders in your talks, roundtables, and those that you mentor?
Well, especially women, because there still are so few women in this space. And like I mentioned earlier in our discussion, my role models were, there were no women. There really weren't. It would have been nice to have some, but there were none. And so all of my mentors were men, which for me actually worked out quite well. So I don't feel like if you're a woman, all your mentors should be women. I don't believe that at all. And I actually talk about that a little bit in my book, where I was, I don't know, complaining, whining about something to one of the guys, one of the developer guys. And, you know, he came back with something rather crass, you know, something to do with balls and grill pair, you know, and just do it. And, you know, you could never say that as a woman, right? But somehow the crassness and the realness of that, and the fact that I was just whining and complaining and just acknowledging that I just needed to do it, putting it in his words just hit home for me, right? And I don't know how else to say that, but sometimes, you know, you need that. And I find that men are a little bit more open to saying it like it is sometimes. And women want to nurture more. And sometimes it's somebody just slap you in the face and tell you how it is, how raw that might be. But you know yourself, and you know what kind of nurturing and what kind of mentoring you need. I'm not saying that's everybody's thing, but it was for me. I'm a direct person. I like to hear it direct. And so I found that for me, men were more direct than women were. But I have women that I talk to today. I have an accountability partner as I'm writing my course, where her and I, she's a very strong woman. She's authored a couple of books. And, you know, I went to her when I was writing my book, and she gave me a lot of insightful information. And so, you know, you pick your mentors, but they're typically not people you pay for, interestingly enough. Those are not your best mentors sometimes.
Was there a best piece of advice you received when you got started?
You know, I'm going to go back to that Nike expression, just do it. But I'm going to put something in front of that is this plan, prepare. And for me, that was around numbers. I ran numbers on everything before I really made the big decisions. But in the end, just do it.
Plan, prepare, just do it.
You can always alter course. No one says you can't alter course and change a decision, but you have to do it. You can't have success without at least trying it and doing it. Yes, there will be mistakes along the way. There has to be mistakes. Otherwise, you're not stretching yourself, but you got to start the process and just do it.
Yeah, great advice. So is there a personal mission statement or vision statement that kind of prompted you along the way, or that you had focused in on and said, this is where I want to be 10 years or 20 years from now? Was there something like that that informed your journey?
You know, Vince, I never was able to think that far in advance. I mean, the only thing I really planned for in my life was a career in accounting, and to get an undergraduate degree in accounting, a master's degree in tax, and then to work in a public accounting firm. And that's where it stopped, because I felt like the firm was going to take me and I was going to become a partner and all that. Never. And not one of these companies that I've ever started, actually had a fourth company that I started as well, that had a short life period because of the project that it was. But never did I have these long, grandiose plans, you know, 5-10 years down the road. To me, it was really about, you know, how do I be a good mom? How do I be a good wife? How do I be a good leader for my team? How do I give them a journey, not just a place to work? So that was so important for me, that, you know, all of the people that have ever worked for me can look back fondly and say, you know, that was a journey with Linda. That was an experience. You know, and I took my people places and things like that. But, you know, back to your question, you know, was there a personal mission statement? There was something really early on that I found in college. And it was, I had to read the Wall Street Journal back then. Like, I don't know, some class in my MBA program or my master's program said I had to read the Wall Street Journal, which I absolutely detested because I just wasn't into it. But there was one day where the entire page of the Wall Street Journal was blank, except for this one saying, and it was, we are what we pretend to be. And it was written by somebody anonymous, right? Like, they didn't even know who wrote it. And I don't know, it was an ad for something, but that was the only thing that was on this piece of paper. And that just resonated with me so much. And it's different than the fake it until you make it, because to me, fake it means you're faking it, really. Like, you're not it, you're not owning it, right? That's different than we are what we pretend to be. To me, it's like, I always knew that I wanted, you know, a big house and lots of cars. And, you know, I was very materialistic in my early years because I had none as a kid. I grew up very poor. And so those were all important to me. So that was my dream. And, you know, the companies I started to get there wasn't important, but I just had a bigger, better vision for myself. And so that we are what we pretend to be was what I live by. Now, more recently, I would say my current mission or my current statement would be dream out loud, right? And that is, you know, people say, hey, I want to do this. Then put it out in the universe, put it out on a LinkedIn post. You know what kept me from not, you know, finishing the book was the fact that I designed the cover, I came up with the title, and I threw it out on LinkedIn, Vince, and there was just no going back. The day I hit press and hit send on LinkedIn on that post was the day I knew I could never go back. Because I would lose face, and I can't lose face, right? And so I was months away from finishing this book, but I knew the second I hit send, and I did the same thing with my class. I put it out in the universe, and it's amazing, Vince, what happens if you put your dreams out in the universe. The universe answers back. It really does.
Dream out loud.
Dream out loud.
I love that. We're going to post that in our show notes.
Shout out to the women in technology for giving me that bracelet. The bracelet with the inscription Dream Out Loud is on my wrist every day. It never gets taken.
I love that. I'm going to get a bracelet. I just love that saying. It's really terrific. So we're getting close to the end, and I do appreciate your time and your compressed schedule. I have one more question for you, Linda. If you had the opportunity, what three people would you wish to have dinner with?
You know, I think first and foremost would probably be Oprah Winfrey. Because I think she's an incredibly astute businesswoman, but she's got a level of compassion about her that I could truly learn from. I think I'm just blown away by this woman and what she's accomplished and her ability to give back also to the universe. So I would love to sit with Oprah. Margaret Thatcher, I think she was a very interesting woman. She is, you know, the early pioneer of, you know, talk about women in tech. How about women in politics in a government that, you know, didn't care for women in politics and what she had to go through to just train her voice to be more authoritative. If you read about Margaret Thatcher, she had this very high pitched voice that you could just was like chalk, you know, like grinding chalkboard kind of voice. And she had to change the way she was perceived by the outside world. So I think she'd be a fascinating person to talk to. And then I would say the other person who has been my mentor from the first day I met him, who's still the governor of North Dakota, which is Doug Burgum, who started Great Plains Software. You know, there's never a time that I've not listened to that man and have learned something or gotten some value out of that. And many of the values that he had in his company, I carried on in my company and my life. And I just think he's an amazing person and just so well read and yeah, great guy. Love to, Doug, if you're out there.
And a great company. And Great Plains was a terrific organization, very partner friendly too. He got Absolutely. Partner right.
Absolutely.
That's terrific. So Oprah Winfrey, Margaret Thatcher, and Doug Burgum. I love that. What a dinner conversation. I wonder what you're going to have for dinner that night.
Probably not eating. I'll be talking or listening most of the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I just want to thank you, Linda. This has been terrific. I so enjoyed having you as a guest on Ultimate Guide to Partnering. You're an amazing guest. Any closing comments or words for our listeners?
You know, I would say, Vince, we're in an incredible time right now with this pandemic, and it's an opportunity, I think, for partners to sit back and look at their business and look at what they've accomplished and look to see which customers are providing the most revenue and what is it that they're doing. You know, I talk about 2007 through 2009 being my character building years because it really required me to look back because I had to cut half my staff and half my people, but I came out of that so much stronger. And I think this is another time where we can take this opportunity, if you're a little bit slower, and sit back and look at what's working and what's not, and alter your plan going forward. I think you'll be so much stronger in the end. I'm convinced of it. So make the most of this very, very important time that we're in.
That's great advice for our listeners. And I agree with you so much. I think this is an opportunity for all of us. I've talked about this, and it's a little bit bold to say this, but I almost believe like we're in a point that's like a renaissance. Like we have an opportunity to come out of this time so much better as a people, as business leaders, and as a society.
100%, Vince. Agree with you 100% on that.
Linda, thank you so much for joining The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. Truly appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Vince, it was a great pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Linda Rose. Some great nuggets of advice for entrepreneurs and anyone looking to become an entrepreneur. And I loved her personal and professional story. As with each of my episodes, I appreciate your support. Please tell your friends about Ultimate Guide to Partnering and where they can find us. And I'd love your feedback. Please like the podcast and provide comments or reach out to me at Vince Menzione on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can also like and follow Ultimate Guide to Partnering on our Facebook page or drop me a line at vincem@cloudwavepartners.com. Thank you for listening to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Ultimate Guide to Partnering with your host, Vince Menzione, online at ultimateguidetopartnering.com and facebook.com/ultimateguidetopartnering. We'll catch you next time on The Ultimate Guide to Partnering.